long-range plan for NASA. And he wanted it to be a comprehensive plan. He didn't want it to just be a one-shot thing like going to the moon and that's it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he told Warner that there was nobody in the agency that could do this kind of planning except him.
Mm-hmm.
He was the only man that had that kind of foresight and imagination and all that to put together a totally integrated space program for the next 20 years. And it would have a lot of elements to it, not just landing on the moon or not just going to Mars or whatever. You know, it would encompass everything. The new stable of launch vehicles, the Earth orbiter, the space station, you know, a permanent base on the moon, Mars landing, all that. A very comprehensive space program for the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a close personal relationship and tremendous respect for each other with Tom Paine and Warner Von Braun.
Mm-hmm. That's what I others yeah. have told me that too.
But anybody who would suggest that Von Braun was forced into doing anything just didn't know Von Braun very well. Because no, that man was in total control of the shape of his destiny, is what I'm saying.
What was the big rush in making, in going public with the word of his reassignment, if you will, with him still, I mean, away?
Because it had such impact.
I mean, it had begun to leak out, or there was a fear that it would leak out or something.
Well, I can't remember the details of what was happening in the news media and all of that, but I don't know how it really got out.
I don't recall. I mean,
but it was not supposed to have been announced until he got back. He was going to take the vacation, and then he was going to go to headquarters, and then they were going to have a news conference, and Tom Paine was going to introduce Von Braun as coming to headquarters, and he's going to, you know, plan it. So it was going to be done like that. Now, how it got out earlier and how it worked out, I don't know. But you can't keep any secrets from headquarters. So, you know, it got out to some of the underlings. You know?
Right.
And so it worked out, and it messed up the plans, because if it's not going to be announced that way, it's going to be announced jointly by Tom Paine and Dr. Von Braun together.
I see.
Yes, please.
I guess it was
at the
mere marks of, it looked a little suspicious. Yes, please, thank you.
But really, there was nothing sinister or suspicious about it, because it had been talked about for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And he told me, he confided in me in his house, that his only reluctance to do that was because of his German...
Well, that's what I was going to...
Right.
I was going to... I'm sure he saw to it, or one of his conditions was that Eberhard at least for a couple of years.
Right. That's correct.
And figured that would provide some security.
Right.
But his greatest concern...
They knew that Eberhard could never take care of him like Dr. Von Braun did, though.
And
they didn't have the respect for him like they did Dr. Von Braun.
I mean, he was just
another one of the guys.
Just happened to be a deputy.
Yeah, he just happened to be deputy, but they didn't. They were. Everybody thought they worked for Von Braun, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he created that organization, which was a nightmare. And it would never work for anybody except Von Braun. He's the only guy that can make that type of a massive organization work. He had way too many people reporting to him, but he did that so they could all keep their feeling of importance or whatever.
Right. Somebody's told me the way that Herman Widener got selected to be a kind of a buffer or go-between. Well, not really a buffer, that's not right, but a conduit to Von Braun. At one point, he did determine he just had too many people reporting directly to him. And that he let his lab chiefs and other senior lieutenants pick the guy.
Yeah.
And he then joked about when he saw the puff of white smoke come out of the room, he knew he had him. They had come up with his choice.
That's correct. But, they were going to combine all the engineering elements of the center, all the technical laboratories and the scientists and all that, and put them under one director of mass engineering.
Mm-hmm.
They never gonna put all the program management and the projects and all that under another guy and all that. But the real important part would be the director of science and engineering, because that's where all the technical talent is.
Sure, sure.
That's where most all the engineers and science, you know, they were all, that was the bread and butter and the glory of Marshall.
Did you get any feel for something else I've been told by, you know, several people, that Mrs. Von Braun helped Dr. Von Braun in his decision, in that while he may have had reluctance to go to Washington, for reasons of leaving his team, maybe unprotected, and then secondly, there's several people that said he was warned that, look, they're going to eat you alive in Washington.
No way. Nobody up there could eat him alive.
I wouldn't have felt so either. A field center director apparently has, you know, almost autonomy, complete or absolute autonomy. You know, obviously, certainly to a point. But up there, he'd be another guy in the senior command.
A low-paying civil service job.
Uh-huh.
And you have to remember who he was. He was Dr. Werner Von Braun, capable of going to any contractor, making bukus of money. And at that time, they didn't have the restrictions on employment like they do now. It was an open-door policy.
Mm-hmm.
You go from government to private industry, back to government. Now, you know, you got to be out for 5 years before you can ever go with it.
Right.
If you had anything at all to do with a contractor, you know, in the way of awarding them contracts or evaluating their performance where they can get money, you know, award fee and all that, you can't work for them for 5 years. You didn't have that restriction back then. So he could walk right out the NASA door and walk right into, you know, the CEO's office across the street with Grumman or whoever.
Which he wound up doing with Fairchild, I guess.
That's right. So he was in high demand.
What I was about to address, and it really may not have been significant at all, is that Mrs. Von Braun, who had not ever developed any great fondness for a small town.
Right.
I mean, she had grown up pretty much
she was
big
excited
city. That she was eager to go, and she really thought she'd have greater anonymity up there and could be even more private a person rather than somebody in this little town, big fish, you know, in a little pond that everybody knew.
I think she was excited about it because of the availability of the art and the museum and the concerts and all that.
That was a point. That was
made.
Right.
I don't think the anonymity was a factor that much.
Another point, and I don't think I'm going to get into this. It's just in the book. It's just a little too heavy. But a number of people have told me, and they are not anti-Semites either, nor am I, that the NASA's Jewish mafia kind of relished the opportunity to get out the knives. All this is overdrawn, overly dramatic, for Von Braun, where he had been impervious to, he could hold his own, certainly, as Senate Director, but when he got up there, some of the Jewish members of the NASA hierarchy, from Silverstein to Lowe to Julian Shear, I think, was the public affairs chief for a long time. And I don't know who else was Jewish, but they kind of, well, I won't say got evil, because as you said, he could very well hold his own with anybody.
He never worried about any of those people anyway, because he didn't deal with them. He dealt with Tom Payne.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys, he didn't pay
But then Payne, fairly early on, left.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in a disagreement with Nixon, maybe over policy, lack of support, or
disagreement. But again, he was,
you know, any disappointment.
He was pure and simple. Von Braun came up with the plan, the 20-year long-range Marine plant. And Tom Payne was excited about it. He was all for it. And that was the greatest integrated space plant he'd ever seen, you know. And so he got on Nixon's calendar, and they were going to go present it. And so it showed the budget build up to like $12, $14 billion, peaked so many years, and came down and all that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard, and they met with Nixon. I was not there. I didn't go to that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a late night meeting, you know, like 10 or 11 o'clock at night in the White House. And Nixon didn't pay a whole lot. Railroaded or ramrodded, and there was headquarters that had enough intellect to ever take do Warner Von Braun. He was too smart for all of it.
I got you.
Yeah.
I heard such things.
Never had to feel sorry for him.
Right. And there's no, if I'm doing an anecdote, there's no point in getting into this, but things like maybe when Payne left, or maybe while it was still there, that a number of people tried to shortstop requests for Von Braun's speech. I mean, they might come in through public affairs, and when he was in Washington, and I'm sure he got many more than he could take, and that other people would decide what to pass along to him, and they might take a couple of prime ones themselves, and that Bain, I guess it was, finally had a decree that
I've never trusted a man who wouldn't have a drink. state of shock. Really,
sure. Did he want to know if you went to church regularly or if you were an Eagle Scout or, whatever?
No, he was more concerned about what I had in mind of career. He was concerned that I was going to be a dedicated person to NASA, that I would, that was important to him, that I was of like mind with the space exploration, launch vehicle development, all that. It was a big part of my life, something I wanted to do and be involved in for an entire career,
I see.
He was concerned about those kind of things, because otherwise he didn't want to waste his time on me, for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So he was grooming me for, a career in aerospace and space program.
And, so this is not
going to want to make sure that
someone to take added responsibility on down the line.
Right. And he wanted to make sure that, I would try to take advantage anyway of these opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
But I probably didn't. I just thought of something funny. I was trying to think of it, and I just lost my train of thought. But you're talking about these anecdotes and humorous things.
While you're thinking, it was either Jim Daniels or Frank Williams told me about a flight once on a NASA plane with Fletcher. What was Fletcher? Administrator Fletcher. Not
James Fletcher. James Fletcher.
James Fletcher. He came from the University of Utah, who was a practicing Mormon, and there was a steward aboard the plane, and Dr. Von Braun and, let's say, Jim Daniels ordered a drink, bourbon and something, and Fletcher said, well, I'll have milk, and they brought the drink, and Von Braun, in a kind of a teasing way, said, Jim or Dr. Fletcher, I see you're having milk there, and we're enjoying these fine mixed drinks. It's just too bad your religion doesn't allow you to have a drink. And Fletcher thought about that for a moment and said, and Warner, it's just too bad your religion doesn't allow you to have more than one wife. So they kind of both enjoyed that. Apparently Fletcher was definitely a teetotaler.
Yeah. This is not an angle, but it was funny to me at the time. Dr. Von Braun, I said he had an amazing intellect, and the man could do anything he set his mind to. I mean, he flew jets, he loved to fly any kind of aircraft.
I got a lot of information.
He could fly big airliners or whatever, but he couldn't operate or didn't want to operate a simple thing like a VCR. Those things frustrate him.
You
heard the old joke about you see the VCR with the flashing zeros.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. If you ever go in his house, his old VCR would never even be set,
No
and
kidding.
Those things would frustrate him, and he would tear up more VCRs just out of anger and frustration. He'd beat on it and throw it in the floor, and then you had to go get the thing repaired for him.
I'll be done. That fits in with a story. His barber here in Huntsville, who's my barber now, David Hinkle, cut his hair for 12 years, I think, told me about
wanted to be my barber 2 years
ago. Oh, is that right? Anyway, he told me a story about one of the daughters coming in with a plane, or Peter coming in with a toy plane, and he managed to get this intricate battery system out, and Dr. Von Braun, the wife of him, could not get that back in there. And then one of the daughters came in and said, oh, give it to me. And she immediately
went in. And we were up in his honor for one of the... He never missed a launch, by the way, and never missed a landing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he always... When I say he never missed it, he watched them on TV if he wasn't going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But we were in his office, and he called several of them in. He had a TV in his office, and it was one of the Apollo landing splashdowns. And we were all sitting out there, about 12 or 15 of us, I guess, in his room, watching the parachutes open and the capsules coming in. And the TV, it's terrible looking, color and all that. It kind of looks like a sepia color,
Mm-hmm.
And so I just casually got up, walked over to the TV, and found a little door and flipped it down and turned the color knob on. Boy, it came in, there was the blue sky and the water and the sun, you know, real good color.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Von Braun said, what did you do? What did you do? I said, oh my God, I'm in trouble. I said, I just adjusted the color on the TV. Do you want me to put it back the way it was? I didn't know you could do that. He said, it's been that way for 5 years. No kidding. He had never done
television.
Suggested or got up to change the color. They just all sit there like, you know, what?
That is just wild.
But that was the way he'd be very animated.
Uh-huh.
And he'd have that German accent, you know.
Right.
And, you know, it just took me aback because I thought I'd upset him. You know, he said, oh, what did you do? What did you do to that TV? Knob right here.
Anything occur? I'm gonna let you go here in a few minutes.
I've enjoyed talking about it. Really.
Well, I have too, very much so, and it has been helpful and useful, and some of these stories will make their way into the text. On his any recollections about it, the way he conducted meetings, you know, of his top staff people or lab directors or whatever.
Everybody got the chance to have their say. Everybody. He would never make a decision until everybody had their say. And then, when they'd all be done talking about it, he never debated or argued with anybody while they're having their say. He would ask them questions. He would penetrate to get a better understanding. But he would never disagree with them, and he'd never say, well, that's ridiculous. I don't know why this or that. You know, like Bill Lucas would, for example. He'd really cut people down.
That's what I get.
Yeah, right. But, no, he would never do that. But, and he would never make a decision until he'd gone around the table and everybody had their say. And then he would stand up, and then he would start talking. And then he would go back and address each and every one of those guys. And then he would brag on them for what they said about this and that, but then he'd say, but we're not going to do that because, and then he'd complain.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would make the decision. So it was not a consensus.
I see.
It was not a consensus.
Mm-hmm.
He made the decision.
It was not a democracy.
But everybody got their say.
Uh-huh.
And then they understood at least his rationale on why, if he disagreed and wasn't going to do this or that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, he might not say anything, you know, they never knew, you know, he just took all that as input, and they didn't know what he was going to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people would think that they knew what he was going to do with it, but he was very unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
He was always full of surprise.
I see.
And he always went for the full enchilada, like I say. I mean,
mm-hmm.
He never thought small, he always thought big on everything. And so many people around him never could think big like he could, so they couldn't conceive that he would do this or that because he was such a big thinker and they were small thinkers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Did he have a temper? Did he lose it from time to time?
Yes. But not in public.
Mm-hmm.
And the smaller the group, the more likelihood he'd lose his temper.
Mm-hmm.
But when we would go into meetings, he'd always size up the audience. He'd look in that room and he would not speak on anything until he knew who everybody was. And then he would give me a little list of paper. He'd write down there, and he'd say where they were. Fourth from the left, this guy here.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd want me to go find out who these people were.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd find out who they were and write a note back, and then he knew everybody in that room before he'd speak.
Oh, before he would speak.
Right, right. He'd size up the audience every time he came into the room for a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about when he's away from Marshall.
Sure, sure.
He knew the people at Marshall.
Right.
So he'd be up at headquarters or whatever, you know.
When there were not necessarily introductions.
Not necessarily,
yeah.
No.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of the big wheels already knew each other.
Sure.
But he didn't know if there was some staff assistant or some senator from some committee or this or that.
Right.
He wanted to know who those people are.
Mm-hmm. True.
That's right.
Yeah.
So they may not be really important, but they can,
mm-hmm.
you know, he wanted to know who he was speaking to, so he'd choose his words carefully.
Right.
Depending on the artist.
Right. Backing up to the beginning, how long have you been at Marshall when he selected you?
I came to work for Marshall in June of 63. And he selected me in 69, so that's about 6 years.
Uh-huh.
And it was just right after the Apollo landing, the Apollo 11.
Mm-hmm.
So it was probably about around August or so when I went to work for him, August of 69.
Right.
So I've been there about 6 years.
And you retired from Marshall, not too terribly long ago.
2 years ago.
Okay.
2 years ago, huh? In January of 97.
And what was your position then?
I was a project manager.
I see. And was that in the test?
No, that was within the science and applications program at Marshall. I had the science project within that program.
I got you.
Now, again, the laboratories provided the technical support, but the centers, they're not the same anymore. They're not organized
mm-hmm.
like they were back then.
Right.
Each lab director used to be a king with his own little fiefdom and all that, but it's not that way anymore.
Science and Applications is a directorate now.
Yeah, right. Yeah. There were other science projects and applications projects, and my project was called the Solar X-ray Imager Project.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the projects under there. Sid Socher was head of the science and applications. I don't know if you know him or not.
I do.
He's the associate director now out there.
Okay.
So he was
and
my boss.
Fighting some illness at the moment. Right.
Yeah. I haven't seen Sid in a while. Have you seen him lately?
Yes. I'm active with the Chamber of Commerce here. He seems to be doing pretty well. I think it seemed to be in remission at one point, but then it came back, and he's undergoing some more radiation.
Well, I didn't know
chemo and or
the last
radiation.
Time I seen, yeah. He'd been through about 3 rounds of that chemotherapy, and of course, every time he'd have it, he'd lose all his hair.
Yeah,
so he'd just be shiny chrome dome.
Well, he's still bald.
He's
still bald, and you know, he's still fairly visible in the community, and I guess that means. I mean,
he's still
I
got a lot of energy. Does he still? Or is he slowing down some?
I suspect he's slowing down some.
Yeah. I hate that.
But he's still, you know, fully employed mm-hmm. out there. But that's a tough fight that's been going on for quite a while, apparently.
This is about the third round that I'm aware of. You know?
Mm-hmm.
He would overcome it, and then he'd be in remission, and then he'd be taking tests, and everything's fine, and then there'd be another outcropping, and then he'd have to go through it again.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is the third time I'm aware that, you know, it's been in remission and came back, been in remission, came
right.
back.
Right. Questions keep occurring to me. Congressman Tiger Teague
Texas.
Olin
Teague.
Olin Teague.
Yeah, right.
His name keeps popping up,
yeah.
And I'm sure he was in a critical position, you know, chair of appropriations or whatever.
Yes, right. He was.
And do you remember any specific stories? But because I understand he and Dr. Von Braun were pretty tight. They went fishing and or hunting together.
Right.
Was it mostly fishing or?
I don't know about the fishing and hunting. I know they were real tight.
Right.
I know they were real close because whenever he would come into the room up there to one of those committee hearings or whatever, Tiger would jump up and he'd go greet Werner and they'd give him a big bear hug and they'd carry on and all that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd drop all the formalities, is what I'm saying, you know.
I see. Make no pretense.
No, make no pretense.
And, you know, it must have been relationships like that certain other people envied or were jealous about.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how that, apparently there was some genuine friendship there between
them. Oh, yeah.
I mean, But it's also
very important that he have that friendship.
Oh, sure, sure.
Like I say, Von Braun is a master politician, although he didn't try to appeal to the masses.
Mm-hmm.
He always thought that his time being limited as it was, that he should spend his time where it really counts, and that's people who are in power and people who can influence all these other people.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he was not going to try to influence the masses. He's going to try to influence the people in power and then let them do whatever they had to influence the masses.
Sure. Maybe very early on in the Collier's articles that he did and the Disney films and everything like that, he was trying to fire the imagination of the mass public.
But I think he learned along the way somewhere there that you get more bang for the buck if you go for the important people.
Yeah, keeping
people.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's where he spent his time.
Gosh, he, boy, talk about a man for all seasons. I mean, he did have it all. Apparently, he was in a class by himself as a technical person, too. I've gotten a number of stories where he just zeroed in on almost some technical minutia that fixed the problem, you know, a little engineering trick or something. Just phenomenal.
And, you know, it's amazing that how he could do that when people who would be talking to him about things were so in awe of him and they'd be scared to death and all that. I've seen people that they couldn't even speak. They'd be so nervous and scared to be in his presence.
Mm-hmm.
And he would put them at ease, you know. He'd get up and go up, put his hand on their shoulder and start talking to them one-on-one. Say, now, let me see if I understand this, Bob. If I've got this right, what you're telling me is that right? And then he would just start talking, and he'd pull things out of them, and he'd get them going again. You know,
mm-hmm.
He'd give them a jump start when they lock up on him.
Sure. Isn't that something?
Now, other people out there would say, get that guy out of here, bring on another, you know,
mm-hmm.
they could chop him down and get him out of there, you know, but not Von Braun. He wouldn't do that to anybody.
You know, there are stories like that about his warmth. I mean, his humanity.
Yeah, he had a lot of humanity.
I think give lies to some of these historical revisionists who are coming up with these stories about his during the Third Reich era, and that, you know, he was heartless over a slave laborer and all of that.
I can't believe that.
He
was also a realist. He knew what he could control and what he couldn't control.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew what influence he could have and what influence he couldn't have. And he knew what would get him in jail and what wouldn't get him in jail. So,
mm-hmm.
from that aspect, you know.
And what would allow him to live to continue his work, or to sacrifice his life over nothing. This fellow, Dr. Michael Neufeld, who came to town last fall, I don't know. I went and caught it. He's, he wrote a book a couple of years ago, Rockets and the Reich, or something like that. And part of his thesis was that Von Braun was guilty, at least by sins of omission, for the deaths of 20,000 people. That he was not even going to say that Von Braun was not a war criminal. He would say, well, it's probably not provable that he was. So the UAH History Department, the administration knew nothing about it, invited this jerk to come talk, and I went out, and a lot of other fans of Von Braun, and two or three of the German, Connie Dannenberg and Gerhard Rising, were there, and both of them had a few remarks after the talk, questions to you, but this revisionism is real popular now by people who seem to have no appreciation for conditions under a dictatorship at that time, and, you know, and in wartime.
Right.
And they factor that out, and, well, why didn't you stand up and protest, you know?
And waste his life for what?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
But, I mean, his human qualities just seem to kind of give lie to
Yeah, and you don't change like that. You don't develop those human qualities overnight. And you don't just make a change and have a reformation there like that. So it was genuine. There's no doubt in my mind it was genuine. I mean, he genuinely liked people. And like I say, he was a great one-on-one person. He'd do anything he could to help you out one-on-one. But he didn't necessarily think up schemes how I can go help 100,000 people or 10 million people or anything like that.
Unless it was through some educational satellite into villages. Well, I think we've covered the waterfront pretty well. Anything else occur to you?
Well, I wish I could have thought some more, some anecdotes or whatever, but like I say, the time I worked with him, I never had time to keep journals and logs and all that, you know, and I know
in my car
he was a real wit and said a lot of witty things and this and that, but I just can't quote him or think of him or whatever. I don't know. Like I say, there were a lot of funny things that I recall now, and they weren't funny at the time, and I'm sure I didn't touch on all of them. There'd be other things.
And no incidents with politicians, let's say, or public office holders other than what you may have mentioned that come to mind, or in testifying or in speaking about a politician?
No, nothing that I can recall. Like I say, my tenure was so short with him there, and of course, a lot of the times I was not in his presence all the time because I'm off in the wings, you know, doing this doing that.
Sure.
And while he's in there with some politician and he's spouting or this or that, you know, I'm off doing this and doing that, trying to do my thing, you know.
Right. So, somebody's told me the story of, I think it was General Eichler, Charlie Eichler.
Mm-hmm.
This is his favorite luncheon restaurant.
Yeah.
That Von Braun was speaking, addressing a Senate committee once, and Stuart Symington, the big Air Force man, was there, and he was really nailing Von Braun on the Saturn clustering, I think, on Saturn 1 and 1B, I guess. And how could Von Braun possibly think that wasn't going to be just fraught with all kind of technical impossibilities? And he said, well, Senator, you know, I think we have some fine examples of engine clustering in the B-36 and the B-52, and he said up to 8 engines in some of those aircraft that they were going to
put 8 on the rocket.
And Symington didn't have anything else to say about anti-clustering. He was probably primed. Von Braun was primed with that information.
Of course, he could have come up with it off the top of his head, too.
You
didn't have to do much priming on him.
No, it was all there and
he
sort of total assimilated and total recall.
Right, that's right. And he was not, he was a good listener. I mean, he really listened to every word those people said. And while they're having their say, while he's putting all this together, so he'll come back to it. So he was real good at that. A keen, sharp listener.
Right.
That's how he absorbed knowledge, a lot of hearings on a lot of things. You always had his undivided attention. And if you spoke to him, he heard what you said. He listened and he remembered. So.
Just an amazing personality in so many respects.
Right.
Character.
So.
Well, obviously, Dr. Von Braun was very good at reading people and character assessment, I guess, of people. Any specifics that you might recall? Was he a pretty infallible judge of people and
He was pretty right on about everybody. Pretty right on about it.
Just his life's experiences, I guess, helped in that.
I'm just trying to think back of his assessment on some people, and he was pretty right on every one of them. I don't think anybody fooled him.
Did you ever know...
Sarah Preston, please. Miss Preston, hi. My name's Bob Ward. I'm with the Huntsville Times. How are you doing? I am doing some further research on a book I'm writing about Dr. Von Braun, and I've had a number of space-related books published, and this is sort of more like funny stories and, you know, other kinds of anecdotes about him and his team. And I guess it's part of local legend that your Top Hat Lounge used to be a favorite hangout of some of those folks. I just wondered if we could talk either now or later about that a little bit.
Don't they have all that in the Huntsville Times where they wrote up about it?
Well, probably so. I asked Mike Kaler, I think, who did a column on you.
Yeah, he's the one that did it.
Okay, to give me a copy, to find me a copy of that if he could, and I don't think he's been able to find that. You remember roughly when that was that he ran that?
Well, it must have been in the 60s, I imagine.
Okay. I guess I can find that, but let's see, you were over there on Jordan, weren't you?
Yeah, on Jordan Lane.
Jordan and Holmes, or?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Mostly on Jordan.
Uh-huh. And that was, what, right near or across from Stedman's?
You know, where the Preston Plaza is at now?
The what?
Preston Plaza.
Yes.
Well, I had a house there where that sandwich and cream sat. At that time, it was just about half of that shopping center.
I see.
And then after later years, quit the land and tore all that out and built the rest of the shopping center.
I see. And that's your shopping center, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Preston Plaza? Okay. I'll go back to Mike Kaler and see if he can find that. But if you've got just a second, let me just hit a few high points, and it won't take long if you would.
Okay.
And this was mostly in the 60s?
Yes.
Right. When, what, you know, roughly what years did you...
I opened it up in 64.
All right.
And about, I don't know where it was, March or April.
All right.
And then I worked out there at the cafeteria.
I see.
And I quit out there, and so I knew all of them, you know, them coming in the cafeteria and all.
Right.
And I told them all, everybody out there, that I was going to open that place up.
I see.
And I, you know, at that time I didn't want to do it anyway.
So go ahead.
Me and my husband opened it up. So they started coming in to see me.
I see.
And him and all these doctors, now I don't remember their names or anything. But
sure.
But they would, they'd drive up there, and it was a big parking lot at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd all drive up in their cars, and they'd get out, and he'd come in.
Alright.
But he'd come in, and you know how little chickens follow the others?
Yes.
Well, that was the way they'd follow him, you know, one right after the other. And they'd come in, and he wouldn't sit out in the lounge part. He would sit in the stock room.
I see. In the stock room,
uh-huh.
Huh? Right, yeah. where beer and other things were stored.
Yeah, that's where all the beer was stolen.
Hmm.
And
I
they
see.
Would drink hot beer out in there.
Is that right?
And when they get ready to leave, they close the door and get in there and they talk and draw all over them beer cases.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they get ready to leave, well, they had all their empty bottles sitting right together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he would come and open the door out of the stock room, and motion for me to come in and count the bottles.
Count the bottles that they drank.
Count the bottles, and that's what they were paid for.
I see. And yes, go ahead.
That happened every day.
Is that right? This would be after work, huh? Was it along about 5 o'clock or later than that? I see.
Something like that.
Right.
I figured out from work.
Right. And that went on for about how long?
Well, that went on for a good while. I can't remember how long.
Right. How long did you have the lounge?
Well, I had that until 87.
Oh, okay. But did it... let's see. So I guess it went on into the 70s anyway, with all these rocket men coming by.
Well, when he quit coming, they all quit coming.
Oh, I see. So that would be about 70 when he left to go to Washington.
Yeah, whenever he left, I guess.
Okay, that would be 70s. And was it just the German-born guys, or?
Just the Germans.
Oh, just the Germans, not American-born.
Oh, right.
I see. And they would draw what?
It was about 7 or 8 of them, something like that.
I see.
I don't remember how many there were. It was, you know, I remember coming in, you know, and they'd be, he'd come first and the rest of them would come. And I'd always think about the mother hen, you know, and all that little kids following.
Little chicks following, huh? Let me see, and they would draw, rocket models and things on the beer cases?
I wish I could have saved some of them, but I didn't.
Yes, that would have been good. Let me see, what else was I going to ask you? Oh, did they drink mostly German imported beer, or?
We didn't have any imported beer.
I see.
At that time, they weren't many, I was about the only lounge anywhere around at that time when I opened it up in 64.
I see.
And that was, we didn't have German beer and stuff like that.
Right.
We only had, American beer.
That cafeteria where you worked now, was that in the NASA, the Marshall Center part, or over on the Army part?
No, NASA.
Okay. Was that at 4200?
Well, I worked there, and then I worked down at another place. I can't remember. And I was transferred up there at 4200 with the cafeteria.
Oh, okay.
Down there in the manufacturing part.
I see. Okay. So they knew you and must have liked you and trusted you.
Uh-huh.
I see. Well, I bet, though, did they ever talk to you about their work? But that was pretty regular, what? I mean, even during the week, of course, after work, huh?
Yeah, just after work. It wasn't,
Right.
And it wasn't on, weekends and things like that.
Not on weekends. Just before they go home, I guess.
And they didn't drink too much beer, but they'd, you know, about, two or three beers a piece would mount up to all right when they got
Sure, if there were 7 or 8 of them, I guess. Okay. I think I do have a little bit that I've found in print and that other people have told me that I'll just put with this information and use that in my book. And I'm hoping it'll be out this summer. And it's going to be, a biography of sort of the lighter side of Dr. Von Braun and the team. So I thought this would fit right in.
When you have it, you'll get it published and everything. Let me know. I'd like to have one.
Okay. Well, I sure will. And thank you very much. I see, and you go by, it's Sarah Sanders Preston, right?
Yes, uh-huh.
And you and your husband opened it.
Yes, uh-huh.
And ran it till about 87, huh?
Well, he passed away. He had cancer, passed away, and then I kept it for a good while. I keep passed away, and then it just got too much for me, and I had closed it.
Sure, sure. When did he pass away?
He's 82.
Okay. All right. Well, it's really nice to talk to you. I've heard about you for years. I've been over there at the paper since 57.
What did you say your name was?
Bob Ward.
Bob Ward.
Well, I'll be sure to keep your number and everything and give you a call when this comes out.
I wish you would.
All right. Well, thanks for your help.
Uh-huh.
I really do appreciate it. Before I go, is there anything else or, you know, anything that any particularly amusing episode or incident that you recall, although this is a good story just already in what you've told me?
Well, really, I can't think.
Okay.
You brought that on me too quick, you know, and I think...
I know, I'm surprising you with it.
I'm not a spring chicken no more, I guess, you know.
Well, I'm getting that way myself. Well, I do very much appreciate talking with you, and I'll be in touch.
Well, you have what'd you call his name again?
Mike Kaler?
Oh, yeah, Mike. He remembers me, I know, real good, because he used to come in that lodge, you know.
Well, he told me that he did, and, that he would look for that column clipping or try to find it in our library, and apparently he hasn't been able to, so I thought I'd give you a call myself. Yeah, Mike and I have worked, I guess, 20 years together at the paper. He's a nice guy. He thinks well of you.
Give me your phone number, and I'll look around and see if I have some of those clippings in my home.
All right. Well, that'd be good. I'm at home today, but my home number is 881-3553. And I took off the day to work on this book some. And at work, I'm there 5 days a week normally. 532-4439 at the Times.
Okay.
And that's straight to my desk.
Okay.
All right.
If I find right across in it, well, I remodeled my house and I don't know where everything is at right now is the reason I...
Sure.
And so, if I run across anything, though, that I think would be good for your book, I'll call
you. All right. Well, that's really kind of you. Thank you, Ms. President. Nice to talk with you. Bye.